Chapter 35. Dr. Lysander Codman greeted the Trouts in the lobby of a building that overlooked the grassy square off Longwood Avenue, where Harvard Medical School was part of a campus with some of the most prestigious such institutions in the country. The professor was a tall, loose-boned man in his 60s. He had the type of long, big-toothed face that seemed to raise the possibility that some of the old Yankee families had bred with horses. Codman led the way along a hallway and swept the Trouts into his spacious office. He asked his visitors to make themselves comfortable and poured cups of Earl Grey from an electric kettle. He then plunked himself behind his desk and asked a few questions about their work with Numa, then held up a bound report so the Trouts could read the title on its dark blue cover. The New Bedford Anomaly, a study of immune response among crew from the whaling ship Princess. Codman took a noisy slurp from his cup. "I've had a chance to browse through Dr. Lee's paper," he said. "It's even more curious than I remember." Paul asked, "Curious in what way, Professor Codman?" "You'll understand when you get into it. The first section of Dr. Lee's treatise is based mostly on newspaper reports. The reporter was interviewing retired whaling men, looking to chronicle their exploits, and realized that he was on to something. He noticed that a group of whalers in their 70s and 80s had been almost completely disease-free for a good part of their very long lives." "We were in the New Bedford Seaman's Bethel earlier today," Gamay said. "The walls are lined with tablets memorializing whaling crews." Paul remarked at how tough the old-timers must have been. "It went beyond toughness in this case," Codman said. "These men had never suffered a single illness, not even the common cold. They died at an advanced age, usually from some geriatric condition, such as congestive heart failure." "Newspaper writing can be overblown," Gamay said. "Especially in the 19th century," Codman said. "But the stories caught the eye of a doctor in immunology named Fuller here at the medical school. He organized a team of physicians to investigate. They talked to the men and the physicians who had treated them. What they found was even stranger than what newspapers had reported. The men enjoying the most robust health had all served on the whaling ship Princess during a single voyage in 1848. They had been infected on that voyage with a tropical illness, then making the rounds through the Pacific whaling fleet. While some of those men shipped out again later and died in whaling accidents, 14 were still living. They were compared to men from other ships, and the statistical differences health-wise were startling. The doctors backed up their findings with tables and graphs and so on."
"Yet you expressed doubts over Dr. Lee's findings," Gamay said.
Professor Codman sat back in his chair, tented his fingers, and stared into space.
"The preliminary stating of facts didn't bother me as much as her conclusions," he said after a moment. "The basis for Dr. Lee's paper was built on empirical evidence that I found hard to swallow. Primarily, her observations on the anecdotes told by the men involved. Unfortunately, the ship's captain died before the interviews took place. His logbook was never found."
"Don't first-hand observations have some validity?" Paul asked.
"Oh, yes, but think of it. These men had been ill at the time, some even in fever comas, and their recollections were recorded decades after the event."
"What was the nature of those recollections?" Paul asked.
"They all had the same story. They fell ill after leaving port, became unconscious, and woke up the next day in good health."
"Was spontaneous remission a possibility?" Gamay asked.
"Dr. Lee presented reports of a flu-like plague that rampaged through the fleet then. Judging by its speed and ferocity, as well as influenza's high mortality rate, I'd say spontaneous remission was not likely."
"You said the crewmen all told the same story," Gamay said. Wouldn't that strengthen the account of what happened?
A whaling vessel was a small community unto itself. I think they developed a shared storyline.
He paused.
Only the first mate had a different version.
Did he contradict the crew's version? Gamay asked.
No. In fact, the first mate supplemented it. He recalled the ship dropping anchor at an island, even going ashore with the captain. He also remembered seeing glowing blue lights and feeling a stinging sensation in his chest. He woke up feeling as if he had never been sick.
That's interesting about the sting, Gane said.
Do you think he was talking about a primitive version of inoculation? He seemed to have been going in that direction. He said all the surviving crew and officers had a reddish mark on their chests. The lights could have been hallucinations or the electrical phenomenon known as St. Elmo's fire, and the marks, insect bites. In any case, inoculation can prevent disease, but isn't known to cure it.
Did the Harvard team take blood samples from the men? Gamay asked.
Yes. The samples were subjected to microscopic analysis. There was apparently some unusual antigen activity, but you have to understand that the optical instrumentation then was primitive by today's standards. The science of immunology is comparatively young. Jenner and Pasteur had yet to make their groundbreaking discoveries explaining why people, having survived a disease, rarely caught it again after that.
Could the blood samples be analyzed today? Gamay asked.
Sure, if we had them. Apparently, the samples were thrown out or just plain lost.
He handed the report to Gamay.
In any event, I'm sure you will find it fascinating reading.
The Trouts were walking back to their car when Paul's cell phone trilled. He listened for a moment, then said, "Okay." He clicked the phone shut and said, "Guess we owe our friend Bremer an apology."
"He's found some papers from Caleb Nye's traveling show?" Gamay asked.
"Better," Paul said. "Bremer's got the 1848 logbook from the Princess. He'll meet us at his workshop to turn it over."
Harvey Bremer put the phone down and eyed the four Asian men in his office. They were in their 20s, dressed identically in black leather jackets and jeans, and all wore black headbands with Chinese characters in red on them. They had arrived in New Bedford not long after Bremer had made the call about the logbook. Their leader, a thin-faced youth with a scar running down his right cheek, was the one who had visited the bookshop looking for the book. He had told Bremer to call the Trouts.
"They're on their way," Bremer said.
"Why do you want to see them?"
The leader pulled a gun out of his shirt.
He smiled, revealing a tooth inlaid with a gold pyramid.
"We don't want to see them, old man," he said. "We want to kill them."
He ripped the phone line from the wall, then ordered Bremer to hand over his cell phone, which he pocketed. Brimmer's blood ran cold. He was smart enough to figure out that, as witness to a double murder, he would not be allowed to live. As he sat behind his desk, he thought about the spare cell he kept locked in one of its drawers. When he saw his chance, he would make his move.